Chapter 4. In June 1982, I graduated from alternative high school, barefoot and in an ankle-length white gauze dress that I'd shoplifted from a store in town. Even though the school was only 2 miles from our house, I was enrolled as a boarder because there would be consistent adult supervision, regular meals, and structure. I'd sort of skipped some of 9th grade and some of 12th grade at that school where, at the time, you could substitute sports credits for science credits and theater credits for history credits, and where my English credits were strong enough to stand in for all the others. Life experience and individual character were also taken into consideration, and after my interview with the heads of the school, I was allowed to graduate at 16. I moved to New York City the day after the ceremony with $235 in graduation checks that friends of my parents had sent me. Both of my parents came to the ceremony and struggled with the awkwardness of having to pretend to be perfectly comfortable seeing each other, while I flitted away as often as possible to have ultra-jaded, ultra-sarcastic huddles with my teenage friends until the whole thing was over, and everybody left campus, and I went and packed up my dorm room. It took 4 round trips on the Hunterdon bus line, its underbelly stuffed each time with my bags and the odd wicker hamper full of miscellany, while I rode inside with a desk lamp on my lap. I also had a huge jar of change that I kept in the apartment I moved into in Hell's Kitchen with my older sister Melissa, who was away for the summer, and I lived off that change for the first 3 months. The apartment had a cockroach infestation of such magnificent proportions that I have never, ever encountered the like since. They even scattered by the dozen from the bed when you pulled back the covers. The little grimy apartment was on 29th Street and 10th Avenue, directly across from the Morgan General Mail facility, where all of the city's correspondents passed, and 1 block south of the entrance to the Lincoln Tunnel, with its constant reciprocation of traffic, commercial and domestic, between New Jersey and New York. Some of the astonishingly underdressed hookers who worked the tunnel would hang out on my stoop, in good weather, and have egg on a roll sandwiches from the terminal food shop deli downstairs. I did not know about egg on a roll sandwiches. They didn't exist where I grew up. For 90 cents, you got a griddled buttered roll, split in half, into which the deli man set a fried egg, a slice of cheddar cheese, and a couple of strips of bacon. With a sweet and light deli coffee in a blue cup designed with the Acropolis on it, and that sandwich, I started each day of my first summer in New York City. "Yasu Dimitri," I said each morning to the owner, proud of my ability to pronounce his name correctly and to speak a few words in Greek. Everyone called him Jimmy, which is how he introduced himself, but I'd been to Greece and wanted to show him how clever I was. Whether he was charmed or annoyed, I could never tell because he had that utterly Greek way of being friendly to everyone. "Yasu Gabrielaki." He smiled every morning and sometimes tisked and raised his very bushy black eyebrows as a way of refusing my 90 cents, which I had nervously counted out from the dwindling jar upstairs. It must not have taken him very long to notice that I never once pulled out a crisp $5 bill to pay for my breakfast, but always arrived, instead, with a stack of dimes. Delis were still run by Greeks then, not Koreans, and they were not the 24-hour salad bar affairs they are today. You could get a can of ground Café Bustelo, cat food, toilet paper, cigarettes, and a turkey sandwich, but that was it. There was no Annie's sesame ginger salad dressing and pre-cut packages of watermelon on ice, no fake crab leg sushi rolls, no vegan cookies or wasabi peas. The corner deli was a carefully edited experience in those days. Egg on a roll and coffee were the measure of a good deli and a good deli man. I took my foil-wrapped sandwich and the Times and sat with the ladies on my stoop, counting the Ninas in the Hirschfeld, while feigning total nonchalance regarding the elaborate production going on around me involving Charisse and the laying out of a single baby wipe on the step before placing her totally naked ass on it. My jar of change was running low. I bought rotten and bruised fruit from the little stand on the corner of 8th Avenue and 29th Street, which was kept in a separate bin and sold for only 19 cents a pound. The fruit was easily salvaged with a paring knife. With a quick bit of work, you could remove the offending, unsellable bit of brown, which the few West Indian women and I who bought this waste often exclaimed about with great pride. "Look at these plums. These are perfectly good plums," we shrilled, willfully ignoring the large brown bruises at the tops. I stole fistfuls of ketchup packets from all the McDonald's on 8th Avenue, and I'd make pasta sauce with it. The Village Voice advertised bars that held happy hours with free hot hors d'oeuvres. After walking around all day from job interview to job interview, saving myself the subway fare by walking, I would make my way to them for dinner from 5 to 7 p.m. With my purchase of 2 beers for $5, I would eat my 2 little plastic plates of complimentary, and to my frame of mind, utterly delicious, buffalo wings, which had just become the new thing in culinary New York City, and then walk as many blocks home as I was far from it. I lived on canned sardines cheaply bought at the grocery store for 35 cents each. I had strategically sworn off the habit of shoplifting because I had this naive idea that in New York City, I would be sent immediately to women's prison if I got caught. I'd heard stories, exaggerated and magnified just as you'd imagine, back in Lambertville, that quite convinced me not to shoplift. I pounded the pavement instead, looking for a job. Because I didn't know my way around New York and because I didn't know what I was doing, I pounded it a little harder than was necessary. I ushered 2 nights of a performance way downtown for $25 and saw Kate Volk naked on stage. I stood on the corner of 33rd and 6th and handed out flyers. I sold something brand new called Froze Fruit from a cart in Central Park during a No Nukes free concert. With my earnings, I bought a dime bag at a bodega that had about 3 dusty candy bars in its case behind the bulletproof glass through which you passed your money and back through which they handed you the weed. The same friend of my sister's who had told me you could do this, buy pot at the store, also introduced me to his slug dealer, a guy who sold little brown packets of 50 copper slugs that got you through the subway turnstile at half the price of a real token. On my way back home to 29th Street from an interview at a Spanish restaurant on 14th Street that I had read about in The Voice that morning, I casually wandered into a bar with a revolving door on 13th Street. It's only now, in the retelling, that I realize I was lost, walking south and east, away from home rather than toward it. The Lone Star Cafe had a giant iguana on the roof looking down over 5th Avenue. It was dark inside, with the glare of midday crushing in through the few windows the place had. There was a tall guy with a well-groomed, glossy brown beard, in denim and cowboy boots, with a beer gut, standing at the entrance talking to a young woman in a high ponytail, which swung around dramatically as she performed her portion of the conversation. "I just have to take it," she was saying, as I entered and stood slightly stunned at the door while my eyes adjusted. He looked pissed. Shifting his French fry gut back and forth, arms crossed over his chest, he set his lips tight and said nothing. "Okay, Donnie, I'm sorry, but..." she sing-songed, untying her apron and kind of scooting away. And there I was, in the right place at the right time, a warm body, 16 years old, about to lie to be 21, and he hired me on the spot. He looked at me standing there, still disoriented, both from the change of light and from quickly trying to understand what was happening before me. Was this a waitress quitting right this very minute? He said, "What do you want?" I said, "Hello, I am looking for some work as a waitress." And he cut me off by barking, "What's wrong with your eyes? Why are they so red?" This was decidedly not Johnny Francis letting me, kindly and gently, lie my innocent 13-year-old lies. This was no pleasant sunny interview by the canal with ducks. But I mustered myself and said, "There's nothing wrong with my eyes. What, do you think I'm stoned or something?" And he actually smiled, and his face turned into a good-looking, warm face, and he was pleased with my comeback, and he gave me the job of waitress, the job I'd tried to bluff my way into 3 years before, unsuccessfully. Suddenly, I was in a navy blue Lone Star Cafe t-shirt with white lettering, a short denim skirt, and cowboy boots. My first few weeks had been entirely wholesome and uneventful, working the practically dead lunch shift with this beautiful, friendly, seasoned waitress named Lori, who taught me how to use a credit card machine, how to write an order on a dupe pad, how to check out my paperwork at the end of my shift, and how to tip Billy, the daytime bartender, the required 15% of my daily tips. Hardly anyone ate lunch at the Lone Star Cafe. It was a nightclub, after all. But there were a few businesses around and not many other options, so we served chili and chili burgers and beer, slowly and easily, all afternoon, to the few who did join us. When I tipped out Billy my 15%, it was not more than $10. I left it at the service end of the bar, calling, "This is for your help, Billy. Thank you," as Lori had taught me. Not even a year had passed from the time I was still in high school plays, and so I said my line to Billy the same stiff way I said my lines in 10th grade in Hedda Gabler. And Billy waved from the middle of the bar where he was talking with an early happy hour customer. "Thanks, hon." In the fall, I started my very first semester of college a few blocks away at NYU. I told Donnie that I needed to switch to nights, and somehow he was persuaded. He handed me off to the night manager, Buddy. It was incredibly loud, crowded, smoky, and great fun at the Lone Star. It was the original urban cowboy joint in New York at a time when urban cowboy was really hitting. Wall Street was off the hook, and young white traders from Goldman with not-thin stacks of $100 bills in their pockets would pile into the place while their black stretchies idled outside, waiting to take them to the Odeon later for steak frites and cristal as a nightcap. I clocked in for my first night shift just after Labor Day. There were six women over 30 in the locker room, spraying their hair, squirting Visine, and chatting easily, though I thought somewhat frantically, with each other. Not one of them said hello to me. Up on the floor, I worked my station as best as I was able, but with the aisles packed with guys screaming their conversations at each other, and dancing, and the live music, and the tower of amps vibrating on either side of the stage, it was a whole new game compared to anything I'd played at lunch, where the loudest thing had been 15 minutes of sound check. I made my way through the crowd by tapping people on the leg with my foot while carrying a large and very full tray of long necks over my head high up in the air. Not unlike the way we had drilled at basketball practice, sweaty teenage girls with ponytails, just one spring ago. The cocktail waitresses ran a cash-and-carry business. We bought the drinks from the bar ourselves, and then we sold them to the customer at the table and collected his money on the spot, making change if needed, from our own cash in our apron pockets. Sometimes the bartenders would be so busy that we just left our dupes there in a slot with everything we needed written down in funny code. Arrows for up drinks and X's for drinks on the rocks. And when we came back in a few minutes, our tray of drinks would be ready and our ticket rung up. In the mayhem of the place, I had sometimes received drinks I'd asked for but forgotten to write down, and which the bartender had forgotten to ring up. When I found time later during my shift, I hailed the bartender, who oozed irritability, and squared up, as Lori at lunch had taught me. I was the early girl out my first night. I don't remember the band. I don't remember how I made it out the revolving door. I just remember proudly handing Chris the bartender my tip out, a whopping $25, unlike anything I'd done by day, and saying thanks. He picked it up like it was covered in wet mucus and sneered at me. "What the fuck is this?" I had never been spoken to like this. My tip out. $25 is your tip out?" he spat with a kind of sibilant S as he had a space between his two front teeth. His eyes were hard to see under the brim of his baseball cap, so to me he seemed like a dangerous raccoon. I was electric with fear, with his unapologetic aggression. He seemed to have not one qualm about generating conflict with another human being. "I made $140. That's my 15%. What's wrong? What do you want?" "I want you to learn how to work your fucking tables," he shouted and turned away and walked down the bar, his back lit by glowing liquor bottles like that black pod critter who has just ripped apart your garbage and now waddles off into the hedges, silhouetted by the little mushroom-capped lights that line the driveway. I turned 17 during my waitress shift at the Lone Star Cafe, high on coke, and I made a big show of it. It made me feel something like bad and good, to run to the restroom in pairs, giggling with one of my new waitress friends while patrons watched. I felt, somehow, as if I were sending a coded signal to potential admirers if I made an oh-so-casual point of wiping the little trickle of coke-laced snot from my upper lip and then licking my finger so as not to lose that last shot of tongue-numbing tingle. We were partial to an after-hours club called the Zodiac, which I'm embarrassed to say that in spite of having been there dozens of times, I couldn't find today. Possibly it was in Soho, as I recall we always made a point to walk to Houston to get a cab home. I remember, with a kind of powdery nausea settling over me, coming out of it often and seeing droves of children coming home from school. Jake, the dealer, sat in a booth at the Zodiac and sold Coke by the line. You slid into the banquette across from him, he cut out the line, you paid, snorted, and then vacated the seat after a soft and unpleasant handshake. Duran Duran's Hungry Like the Wolf was a constant pick on the jukebox, and the last time I walked out of that place, late summer 1983, it blared out the doors as I pushed them open and, wincing from the daylight, hailed a checkered cab, one of the last of a dwindling fleet. In that spacious back seat with so much room for your luggage and the round low stools for extra passengers, I lay down and thought, does anyone know where I am? And rolled whichever way 10th Avenue bumped me. Obviously, I had learned how to work my fucking tables. Everybody was working their fucking tables, I soon learned. The girl at the door was selling tickets for the show while keeping half the sales for herself. The waitresses were not getting lost in the mayhem and accidentally not writing down drinks on their dupes, and the bartenders were not supplying those unrecorded drinks unwittingly. They were in business together. I, too, learned to sell them at the table, to keep the cash from the sale of a drink that didn't, on paper, exist, and to share that profit with the bartender through tipping. The tip out at the end of a night when the waitress has pocketed $700 is obviously a little more appealing than when the stupid 16-year-old lunch waitress hands over a fucking 20. Chris and I had become, tentatively, friends. He slipped me an occasional shot of Cuervo for myself, and only once spiked it with Tabasco. There was a bartender upstairs, at the bar that serviced all the tables on the balcony with great views of the stage, who was rumored to have his own cash register, which he'd bring in zippered up in his duffel bag, set up under the counter behind the bar, and ring up drinks all night long that never made it into the company till. I never saw this, but the rumor was persistent and sworn to more emphatically the more I dismissed it as urban lore. Even the coat check girls were on the take. They invented a $2 fee for checking your coat and then were tipped as well for the pleasure. I was now cutting most of my classes at school, but becoming friends with everybody at work. I, too, was frantically chatting away in the dressing room with Toonie and Duggan and Auntie Mary, the 90-pound Englishwoman at least 45 years old who kept right up with the coke and the job and the short denim skirts. Laura, an unexpectedly Upper East Side type of girl who kept her hair in a short pixie cut and wore penny loafers, had become an especially good friend. She always doubted her ability, after a certain point in the evening, to keep track of things, so she had the habit of bundling up her cash in $100 increments, rubber banding it, and putting it in the waistband of her stockings throughout the night so she wasn't walking around with half a grand in 20s bunched up in her denim apron pocket. There was so much money being passed around at that place, legitimately and otherwise, that the owners had all of us bonded. We all went through a long paperwork-filled process by which they insured themselves against theft. Lloyd, the Jamaican night porter who drank warm milk with Guinness stout and a few drops of honey, had a whole substantial second income derived from doing our closing side work, for which we tipped him lavishly. The sooner we got out of work, the sooner we could get to the bar at 1/5, or the Zodiac, or a place on 10th Avenue called Chelsea Commons, which would let us in after hours and lock the door with us happily inside because someone knew the bartender. I never made it to the end of my first semester. I couldn't get to morning classes after what I'd done the night before. I dropped out. My dad, whose impeccably performed complaint to all of his friends at the time was that his kids only ever called when they needed money, was beneficently relieved to be sprung from the balance of the tuition he carried after my student loans and aid package covered what they could. I paid my mother's electric and phone bills that year, while she puzzled out how to be an independent, financially solvent, divorced woman in blue jeans for the first time in her life. I gave her a wide berth. When Jeffrey had been questioned about the liberty he was taking by helping himself to a couple of eggs out of her fridge the morning after the long drive up to Vermont in his truck filled with her things retrieved from the split, furthermore making some derisive comment about our dad's inconsistent and inadequate support checks, I decided to just send the electric bill money, and to avoid the fraught visits to her home. She mishandled a lot of things in those first years, but nothing more so than her evident inability to shield us from her significant fury at my father. I bought a stereo and got a Macy's credit card. I flew to Aspen and went skiing. I took home more than $90,000 that year and spent most of it on drugs. At some point, Urban Cowboy started to slow down as a hot trend in the city's nightlife, but we didn't pay attention and we didn't scale back. Around this time, a new girl started at the club, and I, for the first time in my life more senior than someone, ignored her in the dressing room. She carelessly left her book of dupes sitting in a drawer in the waiter station while she was having a pee break, and I stole them. Now I had a whole book of checks, marked in sequential order, which should have been returned to the office at the end of the night, accounted for, wrapped up in her neatly organized paperwork. They had not been assigned to me, and I could do what I liked with them. It was the waitress's equivalent of having her own cash register. I used them judiciously over the next few months, getting my cash and carry drinks rung up on these checks that could never be traced to me. But things were slowing down so considerably that we began to scale way back and frequently, in fact more often than not, worked whole shifts on the up and up. On a slow night, 1 month shy of a year to the week after I'd started, I arrived at work almost late and out of breath. I had woken up late and hurting from a night of decidedly more sinister hue than average, most of it unrecoverable in my memory, and I was particularly disoriented from not being able to recall even one detail of how I had gotten home. And when it was time to leave my apartment, I was rushed and ill-prepared. I couldn't find a clean t-shirt or a clean apron. Melissa had left a brief note in reference to the cockroach problem. "Remember Mr. Kornfeld when we were kids? A German exterminator. Get this, he drove a Volkswagen bug! No kidding, ha ha ha." I grabbed an old dirty apron that still had bobby pins and matchbooks in the pockets and a couple of chili stains on it and ran out the door. I got changed in the locker room, put on my apron, and discovered in the pocket one of the old checks I had stolen from that new girl a few months before, who had not lasted even 2 weeks. It faintly registered in my dull and harried mind to take care, but then the thought vanished, and I went up to my assigned station on the balcony. We were used to big acts, Jorma Kalkanen and Bob Dylan and Dr. John. I even worked an Osmond's gig once at which every customer was a Mormon female, clutching a scrapbook and a decaffeinated ginger ale. But this was a quiet night, with an unknown on stage, and very few customers. Laura was working the downstairs station alone, they'd cut the second waitress, and I was the only girl assigned to the balcony. At 7 o'clock, I had only 3 tables nursing their drinks, and so I stood at the service end of the bar, chatting with the bartender. "Things are strange," Tom, of the rumored cash register in his duffel bag fame, said. "Yeah," I agreed, assuming he was referring to how dead it was. "Buddy's around," he said, with a barely discernible tone of warning. "Okay," I said, letting him know that I understood that we would be playing by the rules tonight. No stealing, all drinks written down and rung up. Buddy had been around a great deal lately. Something clearly was off in the numbers, and the owners knew it, but they couldn't find it. Buddy is that guy in a restaurant or club, the general manager who walks around with a huge keychain and has no one to talk to his whole shift. He used to stand, silently letting his presence be seen and felt, watching the floor from the mixing booth, the curved staircase leading to the balcony, or by the pass-through at the kitchen where we picked up thousands of bowls of chili and spindled the paper dupes. He would look on, poker-faced under his cowboy hat, while we dodged in and out of Wall Street big spenders and snuck each other shots of tequila and giggled and sniffled like teenagers. He tried sometimes, awkwardly, to bridge the gap between his brusque authority and our compulsory approval by telling a joke and laughing at it himself, or by strangely revealing something personal about himself and his wife, and it just felt miserable to have to stand there, politely paused in front of your superior, while he struggled with his aloneness. Suddenly, he was walking directly toward me. I was carrying a tray with one hand, bearing only 3 drinks, but still involved in balancing the tray and heading over to one of my tables to deliver them. Buddy reached into my apron pocket and pulled out my checks. While I stood there with the drinks, he scrutinized each one, and I could see his eyes scanning the serial numbers of each one on the upper right corner. back and forth his eyes went, trying to understand their sequence. He and I understood at almost exactly the same moment that I had a check in my pocket totally out of sequence. "What the fuck is this?" Buddy said, still looking at the checks, but starting to shake. "Oh, my God," I said, putting down the tray of drinks on a nearby empty table. "I'm going. I'm going. I'm going," I said, backing away from Buddy, who was now looking almost purple in the face. I feared, truthfully, that he was going to beat me. I started running down the back stairwell, untying my apron, taking the steps two at a time. I ran to Laura on the ground floor, who was applying beige lip gloss from a long wand with a sponge tip, and grabbed her by the arms, hissing, "He caught me, he got me! Fucking Buddy just busted me!" And without stopping to talk to anyone else, I pushed open the safety bar on the side doors that spit me out onto 13th Street and ran a few steps down the sidewalk. I hid behind our dumpster, shaking, until I saw Buddy open the door and look up and down the sidewalk, and then go back inside. Laura came out 5 minutes later with my stuff from my locker, nervously smoking, but laughing wickedly. "You are so busted," she squealed, her nose wrinkling up with glee. "What the fuck's gonna happen?" I asked. "I don't know, but don't say anything about the rest of us," she warned, and flicked her butt to the curb before slipping back inside. It was not even dark out. At 7:30 or so on an August night, the city was alive and daylight lingered. I had $37 in my apron pocket. Tens of thousands of dollars in cash had passed through my fingers that year, and I ended up with 37 wrinkled singles, shaking with the fear of having bluffed my way into a circumstance well out of my league, crouched behind a dumpster on 13th Street. I walked all the way home, north and west, wondering what was going to happen to me, what was left in the change jar. The owners called in the morning. The bonding company called in the morning. And then Detective Sparrow of the 6th Precinct called to explain that he was the government official charging me with grand larceny and possession of stolen property. He explained that the bonding company was the party pressing the charges, not the Lone Star Cafe itself. He advised me to retain a lawyer and said, if I liked, he would send a squad car in half an hour to bring me into his station on West 10th Street. He read me my Miranda rights over the phone. "Do you understand fully everything that I have just explained to you?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "Yasu, Gabrielaki," called Dimitri as I entered the terminal food shop deli. He looked at me fully, with his eyes fixed on mine. "You are coming home too late, Kuklamu," he said, like a concerned uncle. He had seen me many mornings, getting out of a cab, struggling to appear coherent as he was opening the shop. "I'm fine," I said. "Don't worry." I sat on the front stoop with my egg on a roll waiting for the cop car, not in a million years the way I imagined a felony arrest would be. The next day, I called the only person I knew who had ever been able to help me out with money, my brother Todd. He had amassed a collection of guitars that filled a whole basement room in his Brooklyn Heights brownstone, but instead of becoming a professional musician, he had cut his hair very short, invested in a few work suits, and started a career on Wall Street in Ginny Mae's. A few too many bona fide humiliations surrounding money experienced in his youth, perhaps, had driven the artistic impulse right into the basement to be let out on weekends only. Hidden under his crisp white Brooks Brothers shirt, he wore a thin leather necklace with a sterling silver electric guitar dangling at the throat, and years later, when he was a very secure and well-compensated veteran of Goldman Sachs, he wore a silver bracelet and didn't worry that it was not hidden by his white cuff. Rather, that was his point. "This is Todd," he said, picking up the line. "Todd, hey. Steve, 250, 250, he shouted to someone. "What's up?" he shouted to me, uncertain to whom he was talking. We managed a clipped and perfunctory four-minute phone call, Wall Street traders shouting behind him in the background, and he shouting at them with me mid-sentence hanging in his ear, during which he put me on hold more than once. This was how all phone calls would be with him for the next dozen or so years that he spent on Wall Street, and they were, those phone calls, the very first step in an incremental distancing that would eventually lead to a complete and definitive loss. I knew it was too bothersome to call him during work. It was too alienating to try to talk, like siblings, with someone who was putting you on hold every 25 seconds, as his work demanded. The days of lucky rabbit fur leg massages were long behind us both. I learned to call infrequently and to talk fast when I did. But in those 4 minutes, while on hold, he had retained a lawyer to help me for $1,500 and conferenced her into the call. "Jesus, Gabs, I had no idea this was going on," Todd said in closing. "Right," I said, "I know, sorry." The lawyer and I then spent 20 minutes on the phone, during which she asked me to describe the details of the scheme and how I had learned it. And then, in the final 3 minutes of our strategy conversation, she asked me my date of birth. When she put the math of the year together, she stumbled for a minute. "Are you telling me you're only 17 years old and you've been serving alcohol at the Lone Star Cafe for the past year?" As I explained that part of my story, I could nearly hear her smiling ear to ear through the wires. It apparently took less than an hour of her time, billed against her retainer, to get the charges dropped. But when she called me a few days later to tell me the good news, she was not festive. She advised me, authoritatively, to get my life together. "You need to enroll in school and get out of state," she counseled. "In lieu of juvenile prosecution, they could consider you for a juvenile diversion program with counseling for 12 months, and this will also show on your lasting record. But I can't guarantee it, so you'd better do a lot of good stuff, hon, and do it fast." I never even met her. But this stranger, brought to me by my brother through that technological innovation, the conference call, was that walk-off-the-mound coach I'd been in need of some years earlier. Her grip on my neck was not as soft and not as encouraging as I always imagined the concern and guidance of an authoritative adult would feel. She scared me. It was sobering to finally encounter someone who wasn't egging me on to greater extremes of outrageousness for their own vicarious pleasure, and who didn't for 1 second take me for anything but the teenager I was. I knew that I did not want to go to that juvenile diversion program, because I had an intuitive sense that it would turn me irrevocably into the kind of character that I was now only rehearsing to be. "I'm going to Bill Todd, and you work it out with him, okay? And you need to follow up with me in 15 days so I can report back to the assistant DA. And within a few weeks, I was, indeed, enrolled in college. I arrived on the campus of Hampshire College in the middle of an apple orchard in Amherst, Massachusetts, via Peter Pan bus. I was like a deep-sea diver who does not take the appropriate time coming up from 20,000 leagues. People all around me were discussing third-world feminism, doing shifts at the on-campus food co-op, building eco-yurts for academic credit, and playing ultimate frisbee in their bare feet in the rain. I was still in cowboy boots, working my fucking tables, sort of. Monday through Thursday, I wandered around this rural campus with no required classes and a highly politicized culture, and started to get steeped in the language of the place, divs and mods and integratives. And I ate stir-fry and tempeh and tofu for the first time in my life, as it was what we ate in our cooperative housing units where we spun the dial on a shared work wheel to divvy up the household chores. I met no one who knew where to score an 8-ball of Coke. Immediately, I got a job in town at a short-order diner called Jake's, cooking eggs and hash browns on a griddle top ladled with liquid oleo on Friday and Saturday night shifts. When the bars closed at 1 a.m., rather provincial, I thought, having just come from New York and its 4 a.m. closing time, hundreds of drunk and stoned students from the surrounding 5 colleges crammed in for big plates of greasy food and coffee, rowdy from the bands they had just been out to see, or morose and limp from the foreign films they had endured. But either way, closer to me in age than anyone I'd been near to in years, I couldn't take my eyes off them and feasted on their fully incubated youth. On campus, Bob Dylan and Bob Marley wafted out of the dorm windows, but in the kitchen at Jake's, we crushed it all night long to Guns N' Roses. On weekends, I cooked side by side with Greg, a part-time Republican poli-sci student at UMass, and we cranked out 1,000 griddle-topped omelets and pancakes at a pace I had not encountered since my chimichanga experiences as a young teenager. In the middle of the rush, he once called me over to the past to look out at a father and his young daughter having pancakes after a night they'd had at the roller rink. I was truly impressed by this out-of-the-blue tenderness, taken aback that Guns N' Roses' Greg had such a soft interior that he could call me over to admire this father-daughter moment. And as I looked back at Greg, beaming, he tossed his spatula in the air and whooped, "I bet she's pretty tight!" He was smart and dirty-minded and a perfect gateway friend for me between the larcenous crowd I had just been with and these obscure new classmates I was now soaking bean curd with. I had not heard of the My Lai Massacre, the Sandinistas or the Contras, Pinochet or Allende, but in the exact same way that I had been able to put on the navy blue t-shirt and make friends in the dressing room with the waitresses at the Lone Star Cafe, and to recite my line to the bartender when leaving his tip, I quickly enough learned to say regime of torture and system of apartheid and military industrial complex as the Coke's not dried up and my hair grew longer, and I tried to become a college freshman all over again. I was not good at self-initiated studying, and worse still at navigating a place that had no required classes and nobody writing you a demerit for detention if you didn't show up and didn't do any of the work. The first time I cut a class and nobody noticed made me feel from then on that nothing mattered and nobody cared. It was the most ill-conceived, not to mention expensive, education model I ever could have imagined for myself. This one in which you spring loose, totally aimless 18-year-olds on a campus designed much more like graduate school than undergrad, and then watch all but the most serious and exceptional of them flail and falter. But it seemed like a perfect match when I was scrambling for a solution to my grand larceny and possession of stolen property problems. A good friend of mine had graduated from the place and was on some committee of campus something at the time that I was having my run-in with Detective Sparrow. My friend got me the application and the over-the-phone interview, not to mention the over-the-phone acceptance, in a dizzying span of 2 weeks, during which time I never once mentioned to the school my impending felonies. We were the hottest spot on the planet to be for Halloween. Purple blotter, window pane, according to Forbes magazine, or maybe it was Esquire, with Bennington coming in second, LSD dosed out from Visine bottles. And we had, as well, an attrition rate as infamous. I was out in 5 semesters, ditched, with barely any of my basic requirements met. But I was brimming with all of the appropriate intellectual angst and political discontent that had at first been foreign to me when I arrived. Now, I was a staunch Marxist feminist, a budding lesbian, a black nationalist sympathizer, and a literacy advocate. I was also, once again, a dropout. Chapter 5. At first, Melissa let me have a little of the wide-open space of the dirt-cheap loft she'd moved to on Driggs Avenue in Brooklyn, while I figured out what to do next. Together, we smoked Camel filterless cigarettes and let our all-black laundry pile up, while I wrote endlessly in my journals and she painted large canvases of dried flower pods, clearly influenced by the painter Terry Winters, whose brushes she was cleaning for a living. The winter days were pitch black by 4:45 in the afternoon, and with my dropout's prerogative, I did not ever wake before 1, leaving what felt like half an hour in which to rally one's wholesome life into shape. I could barely shower and finish the crossword puzzle before the day was already over. I did not seek out my old Lone Star Cafe friends, and my brother Todd, in just that short time, had become truly wealthy, inaccessible and hard to reach, but also unrecognizable, with the new relentless and lacerating sarcasm of a young man come lately into a shitload of power. Melissa, who had gracefully managed to barely grimace or flinch while I was coking it up at our apartment on 29th Street, now flexed her maternal muscle and suffocated me with instructions about the kitchen dish towels, the coffee pot, the correct route to the subway, and the hours of the Metropolitan Public Pool. It was way too late in the game for me to be able to receive surrogate mothering with any gladness. Meanwhile, if there was any single inch of my own flesh or remote coil of my own brain that I have warm regard for at this time, I cannot recall it. We agree that I need to make some different arrangements, maybe a summer in the country. And when spring emerges some weeks later, I have left Brooklyn and moved back to my hometown. By the time I am gathering a lame and terribly pecked chicken from the pen on my dad's property, readying it and myself for its slaughter, it's become clear that a full summer of country air has done nothing for my outlook. I've been out of school for almost a full year, aimlessly putting a paycheck together in a hodgepodge of strange ways. I cleaned the rooms of a charming and historic bed and breakfast, cooked hamburger patties and turkey club sandwiches at a local public golf course canteen, and picked up as many waitress shifts as I could get at my friendly old spawning ground, Mother's, on Main Street. The Earth and Sun have somehow revolved around each other so many times that, again, it's already getting dark by 5 o'clock, and I am not one gibbous closer to a life plan. I live in the cold basement apartment of my dad's house. That fall, I was often outside in my canvas jacket, sitting on the log pile at dusk, smoking hand-rolled cigarettes, feeling shrouded in gloom. I watched the garden decay and a frost settle, and thought about death and the inherent beauty of the cycle of life. How untragic it would be, I thought, if I just killed the mailman, or maybe myself, and returned to the earth. I was reading Dostoevsky, Who Arranges the Timing of These Things? And I identified too strongly with Raskolnikov's desire to have all feelings, all sensations, and to kill a human being. I had it confused at the time with some literary context, but I think, in hindsight, I was just brittle with subcutaneous rage and bone tired. I had been hustling for a long time. Eternal sleep had strong appeal. I've all but begged to kill this chicken. There was no need for me to be killing chickens. This wasn't 1930 or anything, and we weren't out on the Nebraska plains. We were in what had been my grandparents' house, up on the hill overlooking Lambertville, on the Jersey side of the Delaware, where my dad had been living since he'd sold the ruins. The house looked over a cemetery and had a deep woods behind it. It's true that my dad didn't have TV, the tivvies, as he calls them, a telephone or a microwave, but these were aesthetic choices. There were people on either side of us, normal New Jersey neighbors, who knew of things like ice in the door of the fridge, MTV, and instant ramen noodles. He kept chickens as part of his gestalt. There was one chicken in the coop being badly henpecked. My dad said we should kill the chicken and spare it the slow torture by its pen mates. I said I'd like to kill it. I said I wanted to kill it. I said it was important to confront the death of the animal you had the privilege of eating. I said it was cowardly to buy cellophane-wrapped packages of boneless, skinless breasts at the grocery store, desensitized, sanitized, devoid of any semblance of its live form. This was what 2 years at Hampshire College had done to me. My father, wishing I would comb my hair more often and pass quickly through this particular phase, said, "You can kill the thing when I get home from work." He claimed to have grown up with chickens and said he had killed many in his boyhood, so I let him coach me through it. From a remote spot on the back kitchen steps, he told me how to decisively gather the chicken out of the pen. Adding my own bit, I spoke to it philosophically about the cycle of life. I held it firmly and calmly with what I hoped was a soothing authority. Then he told me to take it by the legs and hold it upside down. The chicken protested from deep inside its throat, close to the heart, a violent, vehement, full-bodied cluck. The crowing was almost an afterthought. To get it to stop, my dad told me to start swinging it in full arm circles. I windmilled that bird around and around the way I had spun lettuce as a kid in the front yard, sending droplets of water out onto the gravel and pack of sandra from the old-fashioned wire basket spinner my mom used. He said this would disorient the bird, make it so dizzy that it couldn't move, and that's when I should lay it down on the block and chop its head off with one succinct whack. If you're as practiced as my father claims to have been, your 10-year-old brother windmills the birds while you are chopping off their heads, and no sooner have you tossed one chicken into the grass to run around headless than your brother is handing you another dazed chicken to whack, and like a machine you just spin and whack, until you've got 20 birds ready for the icebox for the next 5 winter months of Sunday suppers. In my own way, not like a machine at all, I laid it down on a tree stump, and while it was listless and trying to recover, I clutched the hatchet and came down on its neck. This first blow made a vague dent, barely breaking the skin. I hurried to strike it again, but lost a few seconds in my grief and horror. The second blow hit the neck like a boat oar on a hay bale. The bird started to orient. I was still holding its feet with one hand and trying to cut its head off with the dull hatchet with my other, when both the chicken and my father became quite lucid and not a little agitated. The chicken began to thrash about as if chastising me for my false promises of a merciful death and a poignant logic to his demise at my hand. My dad yelled, "Kill it! Kill it! Ah, Gabs, kill the fucking thing!" from his bloodless perch up on the landing of the kitchen steps. I kept coming down on the bird's throat, which was now broken but still issuing terrible clucks of revolt and protest, stroke after miserable stroke, until I finally got its head off. I was blubbering through clenched teeth. My dad was animated with disgust at his dropout daughter, so morose, so unfeminine, with the tips of her braids dyed aquamarine, and unable even to kill a chicken properly. As I released the bird, finally, and it ran around and around the yard, bloody and ragged, but at least now silent, he shouted, "You weren't fair to the damn thing!" Which I heard as, "What kind of person are you?" For a solid minute, and for a significant distance, the headless chicken ran around in the yard before its nerves gave out, spent themselves, and it fell over motionless in some dead brown leaves. This sight is pretty arresting, but I was familiar with it as I had been to the Kutztown County Fair many times as a child, where Mennonites and other rural Pennsylvania agricultural folks convened to sell scrapple, souse, double yolk eggs, and funnel cakes. Bearded, suspendered guys at the fair butcher live chickens and let them run around in the pen with their heads cut off before wrapping them in butcher paper for you to take home. The other chickens in their pen, now silhouetted against the darkening sky, retreated inside to roost for the night. My dad closed the kitchen door and turned on the oven. It's quite something to go barehanded up through an animal's ass and dislodge its warm guts. Startling, the first time, how fragilely they are attached. I have since put countless suckling pigs, pink with blue querying eyes, the same weight and size of a pet beagle, into slow ovens to roast overnight so that their skin crisps and their still-forming bones melt into the meat, making it succulent and sticky. I have butchered 220-pound sides of beef down to their primal cuts, carved the tongues out of the heads of goats, fastened whole baby lambs with crooked sets of teeth onto green ash spits, and set them by the foursome over hot coals, and boned out the loins and legs of whole rabbits that, even skinned, still look exactly like bunnies. But at the time of the chicken killing, I was still young and unaccustomed. I retrieved the bird off the frozen ground and tied its feet and hung it from a low tree branch so it could bleed out. Then I went inside and boiled a blue enamel lobster pot full of water. Once the bird bled out, I submerged it in boiling water to loosen its feathers. Sitting out on the back steps in the yellow pool of light from the kitchen window, I plucked the feathers off the chicken, two and three at a time. When I finished, it was reduced in size in a way I hadn't anticipated. Its viscera came out with an easy tug, a small palmful of livery, bloody jewels that I tossed out into the dark yard. There are two things you should never do with your father: learn how to drive and learn how to kill a chicken. I'm not sure you should sit across from each other and eat the roasted bird in resentful silence either, but we did that too, and the meat, as if scripted, was disagreeably tough. Bones. Chapter 6. I'd like to jump ahead. Melissa and I in our separate homes, hers with her husband and two daughters in a white clapboard near our hometown in New Jersey, mine with my gorgeous androgynous girlfriend in an East Village one-bedroom tenement apartment. Melissa leaves me that phone message, wah-ha-ha-ha-ha, about the bone density study. That era. I've graduated from college on my third try. Stop stealing things. Don't want to kill anybody or anything anymore. I've been working in the most unsavory corner of the food industry, except for maybe poultry processing. Which is to say, for the past 10 years, I've been a grunt putting together a living as a freelancer in New York City catering kitchens. For the last several of those grim catering years, I cooked every July and August at a children's summer camp in western Massachusetts. If you didn't know it was there and you weren't hunting for it, you would easily miss the camp's gravel road, which twisted down from the highway, cut through the woods, and eventually opened up into meadow. At the bottom of this road was a 100-year-old slate-shingled barn that had since been converted, gently, into the bunks and dining hall and theater space of the children's camp. Up at the top of the wide-sloping meadow, butting up to the tree line, were a few A-frame houses for the administrative and senior counselor staff, and a miniature, one-room, faded shingle Cape Codder cottage for me, the camp cook, from which you could look out upon the entire campus below and Mount Monadnock in the distance, and the jet-green forest for miles between. While the cottage was only a single 10-foot by 10-foot room, It had paned windows on all four sides that made everything look watery and seemed to erase the boundary between outdoors and indoors. It had a tiny porch with a step down into the tall grass, which was just big enough for two people to sit smoking a cigarette without burning each other, but barely. In back, there was a fenced-in spot where I hung my towel to dry when I returned from the communal showers across the way, and in that miniature yard I always planted, for the summertime outdoorsy hell of it, a few rows of cosmos. When the dew on the windows in the early mornings was so thick that it trickled like rain, I often felt as if I were sleeping outdoors on one of the longest and best camping trips ever taken. Every year, I arrived a few days before camp officially started, when the grass was still waist-high from the year's growth and the land was utterly still, save for the wildlife. I spent those days down in the huge camp kitchen in what used to be the dairy barn, unpacking all the cooking pans and pots that we had so carefully washed and put away the year before at the end of August, and found all the cutlery and plates and cereal bowls and ran everything, anew, through the dishwasher. In silence, except for the kitchen radio, I swept out the chipmunk and field mouse droppings from the screened-in dry goods room and made lists, and plugged in the kitchen phone, and scrubbed down all the counters until the place was ready to prepare food for, at first, the dozen or so counselors, and then right behind them, the 100 campers of the first session. With my teeth chattering uncontrollably from the deep chill of the early morning, it got cold in those hills in the summertime. I tugged on my pants and heavy sweatshirt and readied myself to go down to the barn and finish preparing the kitchen. A most unnatural and frenetic rustling of the grasses just a few feet away beyond my tiny front porch sent a rocket of alarm up my spine. I froze, immediately and intuitively terrified. One woman, utterly alone, in the middle of a woods, out of earshot. I ducked down low, adrenaline coursing through my veins as I quickly calculated exactly how alone I was, with no bodega, taxicab, or pedestrian nearby, and silently but quickly stepped into my rubber boots. Fully dressed, I spider-walked to the backmost wall of the cottage and stood back up slowly so I could peer out the window without being seen by whoever was crawling through the tall grass. In those few seconds of involuntary adrenaline rush, I imagined, with total clarity, the derelict who had walked down from the highway, ventured along our gravel road, and was now creeping up to my cabin to torture me at knife point for the next four solitary days and nights. Attracted by my car parked beside the cottage, a signal to him of potential prey, I imagined vividly how he walked past the uninhabited A-frames, ignoring them, and was now down on all fours, obscured by the tall grass, creeping up to my flimsy screen door. I saw his stringy hair, his greasy sort of goatee, his dirty army surplus jacket, his jeans hanging off his thin frame, his partially unlaced sand-colored boots, and his two socks, both white but one with green stripes and the other with orange. And in an instant, there in front of my porch, waddled a wild turkey as big as a Labrador, and behind it, one after another, came 16 more. I watched this procession in silent awe, my body deflating like an unplugged swimming pool mattress, and counted 17 wild turkeys with prehistoric-looking heads as they waddled their way through the tall grass covered in heavy dew and made their way down the long, sloping meadow. The work at camp was in an airy, wide-open kitchen with a view of camp life from every screened window. Horses in a paddock, birch girls, the 8-year-olds, in flip-flops with their towels around their necks stomping down the hill to the pool. The willow boys, 12-year-olds, playing soccer just beyond the arts barn, with about as much form and finesse as a kitten chasing a cotton toy at the end of a wire held by a slightly mean human. Wherever the ball went, they all went. The bunks were separated by age and gender and named after trees, from birch to spruce to willow. It was such a welcome departure from the kitchens I had worked in all fall, all winter, all spring, all my life, really, with its wide-planked wooden floors and wooden cabinets and the jubilant purpley mural of happy children painted on the wall. I felt like a severe arthritic, hunched and limping to Lourdes and miraculously standing upright, freed from joint pain, to be in a place where the pine-scented breeze swept through the afternoon prep shift and the fireflies snuck in after dinner when the campers left the screen door open, and where early, early in the mornings, while I made coffee and turned on the ovens, I would catch chipmunks, cheeks bulging, trying to make off with granola bars and loaves of sliced bread. The catering kitchen where I had clocked most of my hours that season, where I had just been days before, was in a warehouse on the West Side Highway. I put together my paycheck among two or three of the highest volume catering companies in the city, and they were all eerily the same. During the off-seasons, these operations kept a skeleton crew of a few cooks, dishers, and drivers to handle little dinner parties for publishing executives and Wall Streeters. But in-season, fall, holidays, spring, and that season unto its own, wedding? These kitchens teemed with freelance mercenary cooks who possessed few skills and fewer scruples, and I worked side by side with them for more than a decade. We moved around from kitchen to kitchen, wherever the work was, got paid triple what restaurant work paid, and managed our flexible schedules by simply not booking in for any days we needed off. In composite, as an entire organism, we had the skills to pull off what was required. There would be someone on the crew who could produce by day's end an elaborate, miraculous bouche de Noël, studded with little perfect meringue mushrooms, and another who could brilliantly organize a plate out for $3.50 that would saturate the banquet room in perfectly hot dinners on clean-rimmed plates in less than 14 minutes start to finish. And perhaps another who really did have a feel for meat cooking, and who might come in early and pre-season the birds or the loins, even though no one asked her or paid her to do so. But the bulk of what was served to party-going New Yorkers was ground out in a robo-coup. Rosemary aioli, harissa hummus, white bean puree, by a revolving and ever-interchangeable, warm body in a rented chef coat who knew not one thing about what a homemade mayonnaise might be. You would never be fired for throwing a cup of sour cream and a little walnut oil into your breaking aioli because you didn't know a thing, just like 100 catering hackers before and 100 after you, about the relationship of raw garlic to egg yolk and blended oil. But even if you were, there was always another right behind you to take your place. These windowless kitchens, all of them, were lit with harsh fluorescence, and when you entered at 7 a.m., and didn't exit until 2 a.m. sometimes, having prepped all day and then gone out to chef the party at the museum or the gallery or the private home. I've done a shift that long easily 100 times. You looked tubercular by the time you clocked out. The debris that accumulated in those kitchens, sneakers, hoodies, but also food left over from jobs, sat in the walk-in for weeks until an energetic and anal-retentive cook with a little hustle and who happened to still give a shit tossed it. She spent a quick hour, her jacket on over her chef's whites, inside the huge refrigerated walk-in, tossing clear plastic quart and pint containers labeled with masking tape and black Sharpie into the garbage. The containers had names of places, not names of foods. The places where they had been on that day's dizzying roster of multiple events leaving the warehouse kitchen in six different vans at about the same time. Botanical, M-O-N-H, library. She could not guess what was moldering away inside each pint container, but she knew, when tossing the shit out, that the event had been at the Botanical Gardens, the American Museum of Natural History, or the New York Public Library. The food we produced in these kitchens was often bad, but not as bad as what had to be done to it to get it from the warehouse kitchen on the West Side Highway to the Botanical Gardens, the museum, or finally into the mouths of the wedding guests in Amagansett. Catering, in that era, was not cooking. It was factory work in a refrigerated truck or cargo van or even the four-car garage of an oceanfront property in the Hamptons, if that's where the event was and if that was the only viable place to set up our makeshift kitchen with Sterno ovens and propane burners and coolers filled with evaporating dry ice to keep the molded ice cream flowers frozen. The smoked salmon and cream cheese pinwheel, that steadfast staple of all catering kitchens throughout all of time, had been touched by four or five people by the time the guest ate it. The guy who opened the salmon and laid it out on sheets of plastic wrap, the guy who spread whipped cream cheese on it and rolled it up, the guy who later unwrapped it and sliced it, the guy who garnished it with chopped chives and arranged it in careful circles on a 16-inch round silver or 14-inch square black lacquered tray, and probably even the waiter on his way out to the cocktail reception, bearing that tray and in his other hand a small stack of artfully fanned out cocktail napkins. The bruschetta under the three different toppings, tomato basil concasse, Tuscan white bean, and Sicilian tuna salata, which was to sit at the Italian station, was nothing more than sliced baguette that had been laid out on sheet pans and blitzed in the double-decker convection oven, then sprayed with cheap blended olive oil, using the kind of spray bottle commonly used for Windex and houseplants. I had seen those toast rounds sit out on a rolling rack in the warehouse kitchen all week. At some point in the catering world of the late 80s and early 90s, someone thought of putting food into a shot glass, and thus the hors d'oeuvre shooter was born. And so, all season long, I portioned mucousy, pre-shucked tub oysters with lemongrass mignonette, or minted pea soup, or vodka spiked gazpacho into 2-ounce shot glasses. We set the filled shooters back into their slotted dish racks. One per person of each menu item multiplied times 300 guests is 900 shot glasses, and stacked the interlocking dish racks in a neat, sturdy tower in the walk-in refrigerator where they sat for hours and hours. At the loadout, someone wrapped the whole tower in commercial plastic wrap, shimmied it onto a hand truck, and wheeled it to the refrigerated truck to make the journey to the Hamptons. This can look just like a dock worker with a pallet at a warehouse, and nothing like a white-jacketed chef artfully coaxing the best flavor from your food. Apollo, meanwhile, whose smile was sunshine itself in an otherwise weatherless world, diced and smashed limes with sugar in coffee cups, filled them with ice and cachaça, and introduced us, decades before it was wildfire, to the caipirinha, the national drink of his home country, Brazil. We arrived at our parties a little lit. Once at the party, the cook working the cold appetizers station, an 8-foot rectangular table with a cloth thrown over it, simply pulled out a rack at a time from the back of the truck and set the glasses by the dozen on a silver round tray, and they were whisked away by the waiter, a tuxedoed guy wearing shockingly blue contact lenses, who then had to stand in front of the wedding guest explaining its contents. Chilled pea soup. Yes, you drink it. Just like a shooter. After the shot glass came the Chinese soup dumpling spoon, the edible sugarcane skewer, the espresso cup. We used all of these gimmicks for portioning the hors d'oeuvres and serving them to the guests on a garnished silver tray. Self-contained items that required no skewer, toast round, or shot glass, like pigs in blankets, curried beef mini empanadas, and sushi, which we always contracted out to a commercial producer in Queens, the one that supplies grocery stores and delis with those little to-go boxes of assorted sushi, sailed out the back of the truck, got reheated in the garage if necessary, and were sent out on a heavily garnished bamboo weave tray right into the bride and groom's tummies. When the intended couple had agreed on this menu, back in January, after a private tasting in the little nicely dressed and furnished showroom of the catering company, it had been prepared for them by the chef of the company, in just enough quantity for the tasting, not more than 4 portions of each thing, and each ingredient had been hand-selected by the chef and prepared the same day as it was eaten. In fact, it went from stove to table during the tasting, and it, indeed, looked and tasted very good. I had been assigned to execute dozens of those tastings over the years and felt genuine pride in what we produced. But by the time the bride and groom, now betrothed, and their 300 guests were enjoying the same meal on a beautiful June evening, we were now on a very different scale of production. A whole crew of mixed talent and fluctuating demeanor, catering cooks, had been booked in for the week to produce it. To be sure, this couple was not the only one to have decided on June 15th as their ideal wedding date, and not the only one to have been nudged by the party planner toward the grilled salmon fillet on a bed of leek compote with preserved lemon relish as their entree. We were producing 6 to 10 jobs at the same time, every day, at the peak of the season, food for thousands of wedding guests and college graduates and U.S. Open attendees, all the accounts the full-time party planners up in the front offices had spent all year cultivating, was being cranked out of those warehouse kitchens on the west side all at once by slightly crazy people. The party planners, 201, had mono and shingles by the end of every June. On the kitchen crew, there was always a Patty, the chemically cheerful girl who could work a 22-day stretch of doubles without blinking. She would chirp, "Sure," with her eyes unnaturally wide open when asked, on day 13 of her doubling marathon, if she could run the hors d'oeuvres for 1,000 at the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens, then get up the following morning and set up the brunch in Banquet Room C at the Midtown Marriott, where the International Planned Parenthood chapter heads would be having back-to-back conferences. She would agree to come in at 5 a.m. and bake off all the mini muffins, mini scones, and mini quiches, and to roll up the mini black bean roll-ups without even checking her book or calling her boyfriend. She would go out and drink White Russians all night, but still work every hour she committed to. Her paychecks were knockout. There was also always a steady, lethargic prep cook like Nancy, and usually several of her friends and cousins, who sat around an island of stainless steel prep tables all day, like factory workers, assembling goat cheese and phyllo dough purses by the thousand. She refused to work parties, and so had arranged her schedule to end at 5 o'clock every day. Humming a little calypso tune as she smiled and waved kisses goodnight to us all at the end of her shift, she would walk out with gallons of bleach and dish soap that she'd stolen from the unlocked cage downstairs near the changing room, and sell it on Eastern Parkway to her West Indian neighbors. There was also always a Rich, the guy who used to walk quickly and purposely from one room to another, giving us all the impression that he was banging out a job, a prep list, a pack sheet, a van loadout, or an equipment pull, when in fact, that was just his strategy for earning his $17.50 an hour to prep while accomplishing little. He was always the one dicking with the boombox in the kitchen, incessantly popping in CDs he was so psyched to turn us on to, as if he were our unsolicited mentor. Rich had that characteristic compulsion I frequently encountered in catering cooks, that incessant and pressing need to declare his credentials as a real cook. "Yeah, man, I'm just doing this shit for a short stretch until I find the right place to jump back into restaurants. It's got to be the right place with my kind of quality." He'd blow that same hot air for years while taking a cigarette break on the back loading dock. "I mean, look, I tried to show him I.O. Lee, but I just gave up, man." It was not only impossible for him to accept his complicity in the crap we were producing, but he was also driven to inflate his own credentials to such dimensions that it made us all squirm, stomp out our cigarettes, and rush for relief back to our cutting boards inside. "I invented I.O. Lee, man." The wedding meal itself, a sit-down dinner for 300 that followed the butlered hors d'oeuvre hour, had sat in the warehouse kitchen refrigerator, some components of it for days, and then in the back of the cargo van in bumper-to-bumper traffic on the LIE. On the long ride out to Amagansett, three cater waiters assigned to ride with us so they can help us unload cases of Sterno and Staff Cola and seltzer at the destination, sat on their garment bags containing their waiter tuxedos and sang show tunes. In the way, way back of the cargo van, perched on a 5-gallon bucket of leek compote amid stacks and stacks of disposable aluminum hotel pans packed with salmon fillets, portioned at 4 ounces and already partially blasted in the convection ovens back at the warehouse, sat Andrea, the freelance chef assigned to run the party. He, dear bride and groom, was the bitter and viciously funny guy chain-smoking Marlboros about to oversee your very expensive love meal. For the 83-mile ride from our loading dock to your spread on Mill Pond Road, he bitched all the way about how shitty this company is and wondered aloud the whole way to the Hamptons why he should give a shit if they don't give a shit, all the while doing a caustic and exquisite interpretive dance on those 5-gallon buckets. And the rented hackers, the freelance kitchen assistants assigned to assist him, to shove shot glasses into trays and to reheat salmon in 5 side-by-side sterno-fueled proofing cabinets that we've dubbed the Wall of Fire, they think he's fucking hysterical. Me too. He's very funny. The death of your party, but what a van ride. That swarm of truly mediocre cooks, after constant, repeated handling of this bride's food in preparation for her Hamptons wedding, clock out at the warehouse 13 hours later, leaving their old dirty shoes and saran wrap belts all over the locker room floors, and the next day they head uptown 2 blocks to the next company and their next 4 days of booked work. Or in my case, to the Berkshires to cook for little kids at 2 months of sleepaway camp. And I had just seen 17 wild turkeys. Not that hiring for camp was a piece of cake. We advertised both locally in the Berkshire Gazette and the Northampton Star, but also in New York City in the back of the Village Voice. I spent a few nervous days culling out the few unsavories who had applied for the job, wondering if I was going to have a crew at all. You have to ask yourself what's wrong with the local townie guy who submits his application for a summer cook position at a remote children's camp 30 miles from any nearby town, especially when he turns out to be 35 years old and arrives on a girl's three-speed bicycle for the interview. I was disinclined to hire some guy with a driver's license revoked for DUI, needless to say, on a campus with 100 plump, nubile boys and girls sleeping soundly in their unlocked, smelly sock bunks. I also nixed the applications of grown-up former campers who had always thought it looked fun to work in the kitchen, and although they'd had zero experience working in any kitchen anywhere, really wanted to check it out. Everyone thinks cooking is fun. Everyone who doesn't do it professionally thinks it's fun. And it is fun, but not for the same reasons they think it will be. They think it's the same as trying out a new recipe for brownies like you do at home, with the radio on. In the end, I was able to cobble together a pretty wholesome crew. Finishing up for the day, I put salt in all the salt shakers with grains of rice to absorb the humidity, filled all the soap dispensers, and fried myself 3 eggs for dinner, which I ate on the back stoop of the barn, looking out over the empty horse paddock and the surrounding fields. Ending my long last day of preparing the kitchen, I turned out the lights and went back up to my cottage and got ready to greet all the counselors and the kitchen crew as they made their way to camp the following day. At midday, bleary-eyed and not a little spooked by the enormous and powerful force of nature itself engulfing him, Sean arrived by bus from New York City. "I need to get back to the Bronx," he joked, when I came out from the barn to greet him where he was standing in the fresh air and sunshine with his neat duffel held closely to his body. Sean was a Jamaican guy with the most delicious jerk marinade I've ever encountered, which I still use frequently in the summer. It has about 25 ingredients in it, including stout, honey, and scotch bonnet peppers. Sean spent the long hours after the kitchen was clean and shut down each night, while I was making lists and ordering and sipping bourbon and cokes in my cottage, making fruit carvings. He was afraid to return to his room where there might be bugs. I think he slept with the sheet pulled taut over his head, like a body in a morgue, the entire summer. In the morning, I would come down and find elaborate apple swans and watermelon dragons in the walk-in. And from just a few miles down the road came Debbie, a local mom. She enrolled her girls for free at the camp while she worked in the kitchen each day. It was always a happy and strong hug between us when we reunited each summer. She was that classic rural woman who, with her husband, does every job she knows to meet their bills and keep their three daughters in clean clothes and neatly combed pigtails. Between them, they plowed roads, drove the school bus, baked specialty cakes in the shape of a baseball diamond with a Red Sox logo, had a public notary license, and worked in the school cafeteria during the year. I loved her. She knew just the nearby farm to go to when we had a shortage of milk and needed dozens of gallons immediately. Much of the stress of the job with children was in figuring out the pars, how much of each item, like milk, for example, would a camp full of kids go through each day, each week. A lot, it turns out. And so I bought it by the 5-gallon plastic sack, 10 sacks at a time, once I understood how they'd suck it down. Running out of milk in the middle of the dark woods with no town nearby and 100 kids far away from home, some of them for the first time, rattled me, but left Debbie calm and even-keeled. "But what the fuck am I going to give them to fucking drink?" I asked, discovering that the milk cow in the dining room, that refrigerated stainless box with 2 heavy levers that spout milk when you lift them and stanch its flow when you lower them, had run dry. 2 swear words in 1 sentence had become as effortless a part of me as my own saliva. "Kool-Aid," Debbie replied cheerfully. She was used to opening big number 10 cans of corn and beans and mashed potatoes that they served at school lunch, and I didn't know anything about this, and I knew even less about kids. I naively didn't understand that they would prefer Kool-Aid to milk. Debbie grew her own tomatoes and zucchini in her garden at home, but was no foe of processed foods. I loved that she gave her kids homegrown vegetables and big glasses of sugary processed Kool-Aid right alongside. That is my favorite kind of integrated person. Some of each thing, and not too much of any one. These two rocks, Sean and Debbie, I could totally rely on. The other 4 helpers were the only former campers, now turning 18 and 19 years old, who had not written fun on the application. And here they all were. By 4 o'clock in the afternoon, all the counselors had arrived, having filtered in slowly throughout the day, some on the morning bus and the rest in their parents' hand-me-down Camrys and Saabs. They passed through the kitchen area of the barn on their way to and from setting up their bunks, carrying sleeping bags and hacky sacks and hiking boots, and all stopped to say hello. The girls kept their hair long and loose all the way down their backs, and they wore pajama-bottom pants all the day long, not just for sleeping. Most of them had been campers themselves and so knew each other since childhood. I'd heard of this kind of enduring bond, but had nothing to relate it to in my own experience. I was firmly in the out-of-sight, out-of-mind camp, and had cogent, unflinchingly honest declarations I frequently made about losing a shared context and sentimentalism and the general faint-heartedness of most people. But I knew there were people in the world who remained friends for life with bunkmates from sleepaway camp, and this was that group of people. Among them, there was so much deep hugging and excited shrieking to be seeing each other again, I often stopped in the middle of my food prep to marvel at the show. I made a nice big meal with lentils and lamb leg and fennel salad and roasted cherry tomatoes with breadcrumbs. I'd been told ahead of time that almost all the counselors were vegetarian. The girls, at least. The guys seemed happy to see the meat. And dinner with all 12 or 15 of them gathered around three picnic tables pulled together to make one lasted a couple of hours. A long dinner then turned into an even longer evening of fireside guitar and deep, serious conversations that were constantly punctuated by more deep hugging between them all. I had not seen such a thing since I myself was 19 and working two simultaneous hits of ecstasy. Sean and I cleaned up the kitchen and made our plans for the next week, while the guitar player strummed away in the next room. Until now, it had just been me and the turkeys and the camp director, who spent the last of her free days painting abstract paintings in her A-frame before the onslaught of campers and their parents arrived. This was the last meal I could prepare that still had adult appeal to it, because the next morning, the 4-foot-tall, nothing green, nothing spicy, nothing healthy, nothing dark, nothing but nuggets, crumb snatchers arrived, and for the rest of the summer, we cooked little more than plain spaghetti and plain chicken. It's hard to cook for kids, and when something doesn't appeal to them, instead of saying a polite, no thank you, they instead break into a giant yuck face and shriek, ew, right in front of you, as if you had no feelings at all. There were moments that summer when I felt more distressed by a 9-year-old's disgust with a fleck of basil in his tomato sauce than I had in the entire previous decade when ostensibly more serious failures had occurred. Somehow, a crack in my fully cultivated antipathy toward children and their insipid tenderness had formed. And without even the slightest understanding of why or how, I felt worse at the thought that I might be undernourishing the kids than I did when, for example, all the caneled saffron pistachio ice cream melted onto the gold-rimmed plates when the King of Thailand spontaneously rose from his seat at the luncheon honoring his presence and gave an unscheduled and wordy toast. Worse watching a homesick birch boy walk away disappointed from the empty milk cow than watching that line of tuxedoed waiters standing there with plates in their hands, ice cream pooling, strictly forbidden to move.